cheeks, his jaw, his chin, his neck. Orderly rose, uncovering his skin from its thick layer of foam, one stroke at a time. His breath smells of warm brandy. His thick lashes lie dark against his eyelids, so near I could count them. Study each gold tip. But you have another brother, don't you? A younger brother. Yes, he whispers. Let me guess. The young lad's still in college. Your own alma mater, in fact. The good old orange and black. All the men in your family go to Princeton, don't they, Anson?
Yes, generally speaking.
I dip the handsome silvery razor into the bowl for the last time, and swish, swish. His face lies before me, immobile, still flecked with soap. There's this beautiful golden cast to his skin, this pink freshness blooming in his cheeks, and he is so young and ancient, both at once, so raw and beautiful and sort of pure, making me think of water running over stone, like when I was young and rambled by myself in the hills around River Junction, and there was nothing but me and the mountainside, and the rush of fallen rain hurtling down the stream beds. A state of nature, a state of grace. My throat aches. I rise and carry the bowl to the bathroom, where I rinse it out and fill it with hot water. Sink the towel inside. Return and set the bowl on the nightstand and wring the hot cloth in my hands. I can feel Anson's gaze upon my face as I capture his jaw. His breath on my skin, smelling so opulently of brandy. You might have told me you were Billy's brother, I say.
I couldn't take that chance.
Why not? Were you afraid I'd tell you to go to hell?
No. I was afraid you might tell someone else, let the fact slip, and then my brother would be in danger. My parents would be in danger.
Danger? What kind of danger?
Because your stepfather understands the importance of family, Miss Kelly. If he knew I was still on the case, knowing where I came from.
I lift the towel away, wiping his chin as I go. Peer this way and that, as if inspecting my handiwork, when really my heart is smacking hard inside the cavity of my chest. My breath is coming in short, shallow bursts. I look up at last and find his eyes, and there's an odd, unsteady quality to his gaze, a warmth I don't recognize, and I remember he's just had 4 ounces of perfectly legal medicinal spirits poured down his throat by a doctor, though he is lately but a stranger to the consumption of liquor.
So you were afraid I'd blow your cover.
Is that the only reason? I say.
I don't know what you mean.
Yes, you do. You know exactly what I mean. He closes his eyes. Tell me something, I say. When did I come in? Was it the chicken or the egg? Did you discover me because of Billy, or was it the other way around?
Does it matter?
I don't know. Maybe it does. He opens his eyes again.
Can you really think?
He says slowly.
I've only known of you since January.
I've only known of you since January. We are awfully close, he and I, there on that bed. My left leg presses against his right. The towel grows cold in my hand, dampening my skirt. Takes all my strength to sit still, locking eyes with this man, absorbing the warmth of his breath, the thrum of his blood rushing under his skin. This knowledge laying itself upon me, waiting to be understood. He speaks hoarse, like something's gone wrong with his throat.
They assigned me to the Kelly case last spring. Found my way to you by summer. But I couldn't... It wasn't right. Drawing you inside, when you were innocent of it all. The more I learned about you, the more I discovered I just couldn't use you like that. Couldn't risk you. I thought I'd find another way. I would track down every shipment, every payment, go in with my best men.
And your men got killed.
and you got canned.
Yes.
And in the meantime, I met Billy. Coincidence?
It wasn't my choice.
Then whose was it?
Julie, I guess,
he says bitterly. Julie Schuyler? But how do you... Another silence falls upon us as I end that sentence that doesn't really need ending. Because of course he knows Julie Schuyler. Why, Marshalls and Schuylers are practically related, aren't they? Live on the same avenues, shop at the same uptown department stores, dine at the same restaurants, belong to the same clubs. When Julie Schuyler came out into society in a floating white dress at a grand party at the Ritz-Carlton or someplace, Oliver Marshall's name no doubt appeared on the dance card that dangled from her precious wrist. And when Special Agent Anson needed a little help tracking down a certain wayward stepdaughter of an Appalachia bootlegger and discovered a connection between a certain indecent redhead and same and furthermore... discovered a connection between that indecent redhead and the thoroughly decent Miss Schuyler, why... Well, that sentence hardly needs ending, does it? Anson says softly.
When I saw you leaving that party together...
What party?
At Julie's place.
You were there?
Yes, of course.
But I didn't see you.
I didn't want to be seen. Anyway, I could see Billy was enamored. I didn't blame him, I guess.
You should have said something. You should have introduced yourself.
You know I couldn't. It was fair and square. You're going off with Billy. I had no right.
I'll say you had a right. You've got a right now. He doesn't reply. Just looks at me with those steady eyes, sometimes navy blue and sometimes almost slate, now strangely green in the yellow light of the lamp. His pupils are dilated, black and round. Maybe it's the pain of his wound. Maybe it's the liquor that was supposed to make it better.
Does it hurt? I whisper.
And he nods a little. I lean for the nightstand and the medicinal brandy left behind by the good doctor. Just a little more, I say, unscrewing the cap, pouring out a wee dram.
No, thank you.
Doctor's orders, he told me himself. 2 more ounces, perfectly legal. He frowns. I place the glass to his lips. Possibly there are more than 2 ounces inside, I don't know. I never was any good at estimates of such kind.
Be a good boy, I say, and take your medicine.
His lips part. He lifts his hand to support the glass. When the liquor hits the back of his throat, he winces a little, and then his whole face sort of relaxes, like he's gone to heaven and seen the Lord before him, shimmering in holy raiment. Empties the glass. I pry it from his fingers and suggest, that wasn't so bad now, was it? Makes you feel a bit better when your side's been cut open by a bootlegger's bullet.
Yes, he says, eyes still closed.
I lean forward to whisper in his ear. You're at my mercy, half-sauced as you are, all bound up in nice white bandages.
Ginger.
I like Billy. He's a dear boy. But I'm not in love with him, and I never was.
He's in love with you.
It's over. He'll find some other girl, a much nicer girl than me. We'll all have a good laugh about it when we're 80.
What are you doing?
Taking off my blouse and skirt. You don't mind, do you?
Ginger.
And my stockings. Can't sleep in those.
Sleep?
I clamber carefully over his legs, the way you would clamber over a pair of felled trees, and find the edge of the counterpane. It's bedtime, Anson, and there's only one bed. You wouldn't want me to sleep in that old armchair, would you? Why, my neck'd like to break. All bent out of shape like that.
But it's...
indecent? Improper? He takes my wrist.
Don't make me say it.
Say what, Anson? I've still got my knickers on, haven't I? You surely don't think I mean to seduce you in your drunken state. I have my standards.
At the word seduce, he releases my wrist like you might release a hot cinder from a bonfire.
And bonfire, that's another word, all right. A good word for the temperature underneath this counterpane of elegant blue toile.
Anson's eyes are shut. His hands now folded behind his head in a sort of self-entrapment. My camisole is made of silk and peaches, the brassiere beneath rather less frivolous. I take advantage of my companion's momentary blindness to remove it. You can imagine the discomfort of a brassiere like that, meant to confine one's natural bounty into fashionable adolescence. I lean over Anson to drop the old thing off the edge of the bed, and then I grasp his upright shoulders with my two hands.
Ginger, he whispers, kind of slurry.
Now, you just lie down nice and easy. You need your sleep after a day like this. Gently does it. That's the way.
He mumbles about how I'm trying to kill him, how we shall both burn in hell or some kind of thing, while I ease him down the pillows into a more or less horizontal predicament. His chest is heavier than I expect, his shoulders like boulders under my hands. I arrange the pillows beneath his head, reach across him to extinguish the lamp, ask him how he feels, whether his wound troubles him.
I'll do, he says.
I curl myself by his side, trace his profile with my finger, down his forehead and along the bridge of his nose, and that furrow above his lips. I forget what it's called. All by sight, I can't see his face. A pure, decent blackness cloaks us both. My camisole is silky against my skin. My breasts fall against the sheets, heavy and warm. The desire I feel for the man before me takes on a mighty power, unbreakable. Like the magnetic force binding an atom together. Dependent not on the angles of his profile, or the size of his shoulders, or anything to do with his skin and bones and teeth and hair. His luminous eyes or his strong fingers, though I crave each one as you crave water to drink and air to breathe. Just him. The humanity within. That sliver of eternity bearing his name, whatever it happens to be. As I reach his lips, his fingers find mine and hold them in place for a terribly long time. His hot breath travels along my nerves, right bang into my solar plexus. Not a sound escapes us, such that the faint, slow pulse of the ocean actually reaches my ears through the walls of the house. The day's memories slide past, belonging to another lifetime. I cannot even summon the pity of them, just the present. Anson and me, touching slightly, singeing each other at a few delicate points. My knees tucked up to his hip, his sternum cradling my elbow. Lips and fingers.
He's my brother, Anson says. My baby brother.
It's a terrible shame.
Practically raised him myself.
How satiny his mouth feels, his soft words forming against my thumb.
Here's the thing, I tell him. I'm not in love with your baby brother. I'm in love with you. And you're in love with me, God help you.
His head rustles the pillow, turns toward mine, I think. I continue. And every baby's got to grow up sometime, doesn't he? Every baby brother needs to learn that he can't have a toy just because he wants it.
His heart would break, Ginger. Would break in two.
Such a curious thing, lying so close to another human being. Breathing his own breath as it leaves his mouth, sharing the heat of his own flesh, and yet you can't see a thing. The cold darkness blinding you from the sight of his face, like you are babes tucked inside a single primordial womb. You are alone and naked in the middle of the universe, and there be nothing else existing outside the two of you, not light nor life, only truth. I drag my hand southward to lie upon his breast. Lord God Almighty, I whisper, I do swan. The only heart I care about is this one. The heart in question thuds against my palm. The ocean sighs nearby. He whispers, how is it possible you can forgive me? Oh, I don't know that I forgive you. That's an awful lot to ask at the present moment. I just understand, that's all. I understand you, top to bottom.
Ginger, he slurs softly, you are something else.
Aren't I, though?
You are the berries, the cat's whiskers.
Why, Oliver Anson Marshall, I do believe you're sauced.
That's impossible. Only drank a drop.
Sure you did. Don't move now. You'll hurt yourself.
I am already hurt, love. Can't get any worse.
His hands find the supple skin of my waist, under the camisole of silk and peaches. And we kiss. 16. I wake only once, under the slight gray arrival of dawn. The sight of Anson's sleeping face takes me by surprise, not because I've forgotten he's there, or what has gone on between us during the night, but because it's the same exact face I recollect from yesterday. Hasn't altered a bit. He stirs and opens his eyes. We meet as a pair of interested cats, sizing each other's intentions. How's your head? I ask.
Like murder.
Your ribs?
Worse.
Well, that's a shame. I draw myself close, tuck the counterpane snug around us both, kiss the meeting of his ribs above the uppermost edge of the bandage, because I am positively berries myself. 17. I sleep all the rest of the morning, and when I wake, Anson's gone. The sheets are cold where he ought to be. Only his scent remains trapped in the pillow, which I gather to my face to block out the brilliance of the sun through the tall French doors facing the ocean. But a mere pillow can only comfort a girl for so long, and anyway, I am beset with a fierce hunger that has nothing to do with the absent man in my bed, and everything to do with the dinner I never ate last night, to say nothing of the breakfast lost from my morning. So I rise from the bed, gathering the counterpane around me, and there on the nightstand, propped against the lamp, is a note that says Ginger in a dear black scrawl. The remaining bottle of medicinal brandy, I perceive, has not been touched. Going into town for news. Stay here. Trust Mama. Then a brief space between lines, inside which I can picture him frowning, chewing on the end of the pen, pressing his thumb into his temple, searching for words to express this delicate, newborn understanding betwixt Ginger and Anson. Trust me as well. Yours, A. 18. In the living room, a plate of sandwiches rests on the cocktail table, thoroughly stale. From the look of it, Anson snatched a couple of them on his way out. I imagine Mrs. Marshall in her long, feathery dressing gown, observing the state of the door to the bedroom, setting the plate down silently. Floating back out into the night, wearing a private smile. She's that kind of woman, I do suspect. I eat 3 sandwiches without stopping for breath, regardless of crumbs. And then I lean back on the sofa, counterpane still wrapped about my shoulders, and contemplate the last line of Anson's little love note. Trust me as well. Now, a reasonable person, you, for example, might well point out that I have no reason whatsoever to trust this man. Didn't he meet me under false pretenses, present himself by a false name, withhold vital facts, all for his own particular purposes. How could any girl forgive a man for such a plan of deceit as he has practiced upon me? Forgive him, moreover, in such a manner as I have done during this night, fulsome and irrevocable, I, who have never yet trusted another human being on this earth. I'll leave you to mold that one for yourself. In the meantime, I rise up from the sofa and dust the crumbs away from the counterpane, discard the counterpane entirely, for all that the air is just as chill in the early March afternoon as it was during the dead of March night, and amble back into the bedroom naked as a shorn lamb. I'll discover my cami knickers down the other side of the bed and slide them back into place, and I'll do the same as regards my blouse and skirt at rest on the armchair, my jacket, the overcoat given me by the Coast Guard captain. As for that instrument of torture, my brassiere, I'll toss it into a drawer. Now, I don't know about you, but I could use a cup of coffee after all that hard work. In the kitchen, I find a kettle and a miraculous tin of Java, boil myself a potful and pour the liquid into one of Mrs. Marshall's expensive porcelain cups, careful not to disturb the spent ground settled at the bottom of the kettle, a trick taught me by none other than Duke Kelly himself when I was but small. The cup, in that case, was made of tin instead of porcelain, and lest you imagine Duke was impelled by the selfless spirit of instructing the young, let me make clear that he intended the coffee for himself. As I sip the resultant brew, which ought to fill me with pleasure, I am invaded instead by a slow, black-edged melancholy. By the unforgiven light of day I stare at my hands and imagine not the heart that beat underneath a few hours ago, but the terrible blood running from the busted skull of Carl Green, and I startle in such haste the coffee spills painfully over my knuckles and the tears follow, a regular damn flood, because I'm alone, hidden, trapped in an expensive little hut at the tip of Long Island, and I cannot see a way out. Howsoever mightily I am loved inside it, howsoever mighty the man who loves me, who has gone into town in search of news. 19. The tears do run out, however, don't they always? You can't cry forever. I dry my face and freshen myself up in the bathroom, ignoring the blood-stained bandages in the wastebasket. Finish my coffee and hunt inside the pockets of my suit jacket until I find the small packet of papers my mama bequeathed unto me. Yes, those. Have you forgotten? I surely haven't. I've carried them everywhere, work and play, nestled against my ribs where I can actually feel them. The only place I haven't conveyed that packet is the open air. I have not broken the string that holds the brown envelope together, nor yet read a single paragraph of what lies inside. I can't say why, only that the thought of those words fills me with dread. The possibility of perhaps seeing my father's own hand, the contents of his private mind, his opinion on the subject of my mother, and maybe even me, sets my stomach to vomit. As I said, I can't say why. But I do take comfort from the presence of that lump, nestled next to my heart, the square edges and stiffness of it, like a passport or checkbook, an object that testifies to my origins and importance, to the incontestable fact that I have a father at all. Or, at the very least, a flesh-and-blood fellow who took the trouble to sire me. I stare now at the brown paper, the faded red twine that binds the envelope at each edge, and the usual bile sloshes queasily in my belly. Now, you may think that I lay claim to a long and undistinguished history of immoral dalliance, from Anatole up to the present day. I guess I can't blame you for that conclusion. After all, I'm the kind of girl who accepts money to bear her naked bounty to the gaze of thousands of strangers, aren't I? Moreover, I admitted young Billy to my bed, and now Billy's brother, and that's just the lovers I've taken the trouble to mention. But the fact is, believe me or no, my personal role of dishonor is less populous than the fingers of one hand, and what is more, upon every occasion except the one just passed, I have paid the most rigorous attention to ensure that nothing more derives of these unions than pleasure and friendship, if you know what I mean. Why, I lived in the utmost fear for 2 months after my departure from River Junction, supposing I might be laid under sentence of life. I then paid utmost attention to the hush-hush chatter of the girls on their lunch breaks, learning how such a possibility might be prevented. And when I lay with Anatole that very first time, I inquired after the matter, and then I made myself explicit. I might have been naive, but I knew where babies came from. Because why? Because that was how I came into the world, that's why. That was how my mother returned from the wicked city in a state of disgrace, and enslaved herself to the likes of Duke Kelly, to be laid out upon a rack of penance. And now, in our enlightened modern day, just about every drugstore on every corner of Manhattan Island will sell a fellow a state-of-the-art, vulcanized rubber condom with no questions asked. And in that case, I'll be damned if I pay for my sins as my mother did. I'll be damned if I return to River Junction in a state of disgrace and enslave myself to the likes of Duke Kelly. Except this past night. Except when Oliver Anson Marshall curved his broad back and hollered my name into the darkness like a man at revival, wearing nothing whatsoever but a white bandage about the middle of his chest, an omission for which I have no sensible excuse, no conceivable explanation. Only the recklessness that comes of tossing your heart over the moon, the audacity of love. And maybe this act of foolish trust has something to do with the way I pluck my fingers upon the string holding my mama's treasured papers together, like Bruno plucks his fingers upon the strings of a double bass to elicit some kind of noise. Maybe the night before gives me some inkling as to the possible innards of this plain brown envelope. Maybe I do glimpse why my mama might have acted so reckless as she did, when the century was new and full of hope, and so was she. Maybe if I part these strings and open this envelope, I will discover the story of how I came to be. And it will be beautiful instead of squalid. Right? 20. The brown paper packet bequeathed to me by my mama contains a series of pages, all folded up snug, likely notes or letters. Certainly they have the feel of notepaper, the expensive kind, trim and glossy, each one identical to the next. There are no envelopes at all. I don't know if that's because they were lost or they were thrown away, or because they never existed at all. Maybe the United States Postal Service bore no witness to the commerce of my parents. Now I spend too much time altogether in running my fingers over said notepaper, like I am Sherlock Holmes trying to discover somebody's age and employment and history of sickness from the quality of the stock and the angle of the folds. Sip my coffee and swallow back the bile wanting to rise from my belly. It's only a few letters, after all. A few letters written by some Manhattan cad to my poor dead mama. I finish the coffee and unfold the topmost. Best beloved, all morning I have been staring out the window at a busy metropolitan street that cares nothing at all for my little sorrows. I can see only your darling face and your soft hair and the delicate skin of your legs which I kissed again and again in such rapture. Thank you forever, darling girl, for the privilege you have at last afforded me. For an ecstasy more sublime than any mortal man deserves to know, for, above all else, that pure jewel with which you so generously presented me. The most fortunate man alive. A sacrifice for which I shall always honor and venerate you. I return to the apartment. I now reserve the word home for that sweet nest I departed in such regret, as in a kind of dream. Have the flowers yet arrived? I am picturing your face as you bury your dear nose among the blooms, And then my imagination wanders into more secret gardens, and a bed upon which those flowers are artlessly strewn, and you lying atop all. Your exquisite pale limbs open to my embrace, your fragrant breast crested by petals of infinitely greater fascination. I am wild to see you again, wild to clasp you once more, wild to press my lips in worship upon your beauty. This separation of our two souls, which was once only painful, is now intolerable. This very moment, I am forming plans for our reunion, a meeting which, I promise, shall know no such cruel end as oppressed us this dawn. I suppose in the eyes of the self-righteous we have done something wicked. But how can acts so sacred signify anything but goodness? God will forgive us. He must forgive us, for he alone reads our hearts and knows what is written there. On mine, there is nothing but love. Now grown a thousandfold for my dearest, dearest girl, who has bound herself to me more securely than any bride. Wait for me. Believe in me. Your own, Tiger. The strangest feeling steals over me as I read these lines once, and then, because words like that sort of swim in your eyes the first time, read them again. I think, first of all, what nonsense! Nobody writes a letter like that. Certainly not anymore. Words like clasp and venerate and rapture, ideas like sacred and honor, have been trampled over and soiled in the mud of French battlefields and modern science. And after such a terrible mucking, you cannot ever retrieve such words again. Not in poetry and not in prose. Not letters nor conversation. I think, Mama, you poor sucker, you didn't stand a chance, did you? Not a chance against a swell fellow like that, with such language at his command. You must have thought he meant it. You must have thought he actually cared you were a virgin. That he really did imagine your innocence as a pledge of trust instead of a prize to be captured. And then I think, haven't I just committed the same damn act? Haven't I just fallen for a swell fellow? Opened my exquisite pale limbs to his embrace because I thought, like Almighty God himself, I guess, I could see what was written on his heart. I rise from the sofa and make my way to the bedroom. The bedside table, where I lift Anson's note and hold it next to the one written by the man I must presume to be my father, a man apparently known to my mama by the interesting nickname Tiger. The authors are likely separated by about a quarter century, so near as I can judge, and I reckon it's been a real doozy of a quarter century, because these two letters might as well belong to different eons. Different wings of a museum on the history of the epistolary arts. One trailing long vines of floral verbiage. The other one, well, Anson. Nothing alike at all, except perhaps the final lines. Trust me. Believe in me. Yours. The old story. My breasts ache. My stomach churns. I sink my bottom onto the edge of the mattress, atop the twist of bedsheets and the mess of pillows. Rest my hand on the spot where Anson's head lay. Where not 12 hours ago, hot of skin and tingling of nerve, I settled him carefully back in the comfort of his mama's pool house mattress and told him not to strain himself, not to risk those brand new stitches holding the side of his hide together. Where I mounted high, and sank him deep inside me, all in the dark, all without seeing, only feeling the tremor of his muscles at each fresh stroke, each beat of the rhythm that held us together. I confess I used him hard as he used me. I held his fingers to my hips and showed him how to carry us both to the shivering brink. At the instant of culmination, his ecstasy was mine. His holler of sacred joy came in chorus with my own, rising directly upward to the ears of the Almighty. And I sank down upon his slick chest, skin for skin, pant for pant, and his hands, now free, roamed over me as if in worship of this beautiful sin we had just committed. This act of trust, this sacrifice of a pure jewel for which I would always venerate him. Because there does exist one singular difference between my mother and me, in our reckless orisons, besides the letters our lovers wrote us afterward. The virgin in my bed wasn't me. 21. At which point, the door bangs open in the living room, and I spring to my feet, drying my eyes, tossing aside my opposing letters. "Anson!" I cry, bounding through the bedroom doorway and into the other room, where I stop so short I like to tumble over my own feet. "Well now," says the platinum goddess standing there in the sunshine, "I guess that's the last time I'll bother to give any poor girl the benefit of my well-meaning advice."
New York City, 1998. Ella felt the strangest sense of deja vu as they throttled down the Long Island Expressway, having just parted company with the eastern edge of Queens. Not because she'd been making this exact journey every month for the past 3 years, ever since Cousin Lily finally booted Aunt Julie out of her Gramercy duplex for the crime of strolling through a baby shower in the living room in order to pour herself a gin and tonic, wearing nothing but a negligee made of sheer peach silk, but because of something else, a memory she couldn't quite pin down. Fleeing the city, dirty tenements skidding past the windows, a March rain clicking on the glass. In the front seat, her mother and Aunt Viv were talking about summer plants. Aunt Viv's youngest was getting married over July 4th weekend at the beach place in East Hampton, and the two of them were scheming to pull in as many cousins as possible for a family reunion. "Before everybody kicks off," Mama said, cheerfully. That sounded as if it was going to last a week at least. The problem was accommodation. Too many cousins.
"But I don't think half of Tiny's brood will make it," Aunt Viv said. "They hardly ever do. She never should have moved to California." "Honestly, Vivs, can you blame her? Those in-laws of hers. The horrid Harcastles. I know. But children should grow up with family near. It's just wrong. Skylar's heading west like 49ers. Her husband's sister is out there. Plenty of cousins on his side. That doesn't count. I need more coffee. Actually, I need a Bloody Mary, but you always make me drive."
Ella's mother unscrewed the lid on the nearest thermos, sniffed, replaced the lid, and opened the other one.
"It's your country out here. I never liked the Hamptons. Speaking of family traitors... Well, it worked out well, didn't it? At least we didn't have to fight about who got the summer place when Mummy died."
Aunt Viv held out her ceramic commuter mug, and Mama unscrewed that lid and refilled it from the thermos. She glanced in the rearview mirror.
"Everything all right back there, darling? You're awfully quiet."
Ella met her aunt's familiar, tip-tilted blue eye in the mirror. That beautifully arched eyebrow she'd always envied. Ella's brows were thick and straight. She'd somehow missed the Skylar genes in that respect, as in so many others. Her own eyes tilted downward at the ends, instead of upward, hooded instead of deep-set. Only their color matched the irises of the two women in the front seat, except that her blue eyes took on a lighter shade, like someone had mixed white paint into the can. "I'm always quiet," she said, "especially when you two glamour pusses take the stage." Aunt Viv smiled back in the mirror.
"Oh, we're just a couple of old broads now, aren't we, Pepper? Husbands and kids and grandkids crawling around." "You've got grandkids," Mama said.
There was a little silence.
"Darling,"
Aunt Viv said in a low voice, Ella turned to the Labrador sitting on the blanket beside her and caressed a pair of soft chocolate ears. The dog looked up and sighed. There were several new gray hairs around her eyes. Ella touched them with her finger. Poor Bundle. She's looking old.
Like all of us, I guess,
Aunt Viv said.
Speak for yourself, Granny, said Mama. Ella, how's your apartment? Have you finished unpacking yet?
Sort of.
Sort of? What's the latest on that dishy fellow upstairs? The musician?
I never said he was dishy.
Not in so many words. Well?
Mama, we're just friends. He has a girlfriend.
And? Is he happy with her?
Mama!
Well, is he?
It doesn't matter, okay? He has a girlfriend. He's off limits.
Darling, what a terribly sexist thing to say. As if he's just some helpless being who can't resist temptation. He's got a right to make that decision on his own, to choose between the two of you.
Yeah? And how does that make me any better than the women Patrick slept with?
That was Patrick's choice.
Ella released Bundle's ears and turned to look out the window. Anyway, I think I'm moving out. As soon as I can find another place.
Moving out? But you just moved in, and I thought you liked it. Why on earth?
Because I may have lost my job. Because the building next door is probably haunted. Because I'm falling stupidly in love with the man upstairs, and I can't seem to stop. I just realized it's not right, after all, Ella said. Not the right place for me. By the time they pulled into the parking lot at the Meadows, the rain had leveled off to a steady drizzle. There was an ambulance out front, lights pulsing in resignation. There was almost always an ambulance out front at Maidstone Meadows. You pulled in, hoping it wasn't intended for the person you were visiting. Mama and Aunt Viv both wore neat, fitted trench coats, belted at the waist, reaching just above the knee. Identical, thoroughbred legs shod in graceful, expensive pumps. Alligator for Aunt Viv, patent leather for Mama. Aunt Viv extracted an enormous golf umbrella from the rear of the station wagon and put it up, so they walked in a strange, awkward huddle to the front door, which was automatic because of the wheelchairs. Inside, the smell of vegetable soup and lemon oil rolled over them. The receptionist looked up and smiled.
"Oh, hello, Mrs. Domerick! Mrs. Salisbury! She's already in the private dining room, waiting for you."
Ella was used to going unnoticed in the company of her mother and aunt. She unzipped her barber coat and shook out her hair, which, despite the umbrella, had managed to collect an assortment of raindrops and was already starting to crimp. Mama bantered a bit with the receptionist, while Aunt Viv stowed the umbrella in the stand and hung up her trench coat on the rack. The Meadows was that kind of place. You bantered with the receptionist. You made yourself at home. Why not? Nobody here was making do on Social Security and Medicare. You bought your own apartment and filled it with your priceless artifacts, your decor of dull, studied, elegant shabbiness. The exterior of gray cedar shingle and crisp white trim looked exactly like all the clubs and mansions in the Hamptons, such that people often mistook the Meadows for an especially roomy private residence. Actually, Ella liked the place. If she had to admit it, she wanted to end up here one day. Everyone at the Meadows had been born in the early part of the century, had gone to war at least once, had survived depression and nukes and the death of the world as they knew it. They'd started out practically on horseback and watched men land on the moon. Now, they sat, as Aunt Julie did, in reproduction Sheraton chairs while waiters served things like tomato aspic or deviled eggs or watercress soup or shrimp cocktail, followed by sirloin tips in mushroom sauce or lobster salad or calf's liver with onions. Complaining, as Aunt Julie did, in her quivering 96-year-old voice about the weakness of the cocktails.
"They came for Bitsy today," she said, nodding at the window. "Poor thing. Went just like that, right after breakfast. I expect I'm next. Remember what I told you about my navy Chanel suit, Vivian, and the pearls?"
"Julie, I've said it before, and I'll say it again," said Aunt Viv. "You look much better in the green."
"Also," said Mama, "those pearls are mine. I'm not passing into eternal rest wearing imitation pearls, Pepper darling."
"You'll never know the difference."
"I will know,"
Aunt Julie said, banging the table with her skeleton fist.
"And I'll haunt you both the rest of your miserable days."
"Aren't you doing that already? Besides, darling, where you're going, the poor things will only burn to a crisp, real or fake."
"Ouch,"
Aunt Julie said, sipping her gin. Ella sat and listened, as she always did, listened and observed, lifting her voice only to ask for salt or more wine, say yes or no, chuckle on cue. Aunt Julie had her figure to maintain, so the main course was a scoop of tuna salad, heavy on the celery, served on a lettuce leaf with tomato and avocado. Or, as Aunt Julie called it, avocado pear. Ella and Mama and Aunt Viv shared a bottle of white burgundy while Aunt Julie stuck to gin. Afterward, there was a strawberry shortcake and flaccid coffee. Aunt Julie scraped up the whipped cream with her fork and said, in her old lady vibrato,
"Poor Bitsy. Her husband died 8 or 9 years ago. I slept with him once."
She frowned and dropped another lump of sugar in her coffee. Her hand trembled.
"No, twice. There was that time on the Rotterdam."
"I don't know how you keep track," said Mama. "You slept with everybody."
"That may be true, but we were discreet in our day. Everything was so amicable."
She looked at Ella, for the first time since the powdery kisses had been exchanged an hour ago.
"Wasn't it, darling?"
"I don't know," Ella said. "Maybe it feels that way in hindsight. I don't know if poor Bitsy would agree."
Said Aunt Julie. "Look at you. You've gained 2 cup sizes. You're not pregnant, are you?"
"God, no," Ella said. "It's just this jacket." Aunt Julie looked at Ella's mother and then Aunt Viv.
"Off you go, the two of you. I've got a few things to say to my niece."
"Grandniece," said Aunt Viv.
"Great-grandniece," said Mama.
"Honestly," said Ella, "I really don't think..." Aunt Julie waved her hands.
"Go on, scat, and tell them to bring me a Brandy Alexander while you're twiddling your thumbs in my parlor. I have a feeling I'm going to need it."
Ella crossed her knife and fork on the plate and sat back in her chair.
"Make it 2.
She said.
"Divorce?"
Aunt Julie made a sound of disgust.
"Is it really necessary to do something so vulgar?"
"For God's sake, you divorced 3 times.
"Yes, but we could afford it. Now everybody's divorcing. It's become dreadfully middle class, Ella."
She patted her legs, which were covered in blue wool boucle to the knee and sheer nude pantyhose below. The legs, as she was fond of saying, were the last things to go, and Aunt Julie always made the most of what she had. She dressed her lips in the same magenta she'd started wearing in 1960, and every 3 weeks a dutiful hairdresser visited her apartment to touch up the gold in her hair. She disdained maquillage. At my age, it only makes you look worse, except for a clump of mascara on each of her remaining 10 eyelashes and a dusting of Max Factor loose powder all over.
"Damn it all," she said. "Here I am, looking for my cigarettes."
"But you don't smoke."
"Not since 1972, but I still miss them, especially at a moment like this."
"What kind of moment is that?"
"Passing along the benefit of my vast wisdom to some young thing who probably thinks she knows better."
Aunt Julie hacked out a roomy cough and inspected the bottom of her coffee cup.
"Your mama says you caught him with his pants down."
"That pretty much sums it up."
Ella paused. "Actually, they were shorts."
"Well, I'm not surprised. I knew right away he'd be slipping it elsewhere if he wasn't already."
"What? How?"
"Darling,"
Aunt Julie said witheringly.
"I know the type, believe me. It was somebody's wedding when I first met him. Your cousin, Margot? I think that was it, at the beach house. He was dancing with one of the bridesmaids, and I could see it plain as day. Oh, my, yes. There are men who flirt a bit, just because they like women so much, but they don't mean any harm. And there are men who flirt with purpose, because they want to get laid."
"Aunt Julie!"
"Oh, don't be shocked. I know the difference, all right. And you're Peter."
"Patrick?"
"Whatever. I wouldn't be surprised if he slept with that girl, that bridesmaid. Awful lilac dress. I wouldn't be surprised if he slept with her sometime during the evening. So many dark corners on a beach at night."
Ella, who remembered that wedding well, the first time she'd brought Patrick to a family event, also remembered going looking for him at midnight, when the band picked up again after a break and started playing some Jim Morrison song that she and Patrick liked. How he emerged suddenly from the shadows near the pool, looking handsomely disheveled and bright of eye. They danced to the song. They'd gone back to the hotel and had hot, drunken wedding sex. Terrible hangover at brunch the next day. That was the end of June, a few months after they'd met. Ella pushed her plate of half-eaten shortcake out of sight to the left.
"Anyway," Aunt Julie said, "you probably knew that already, if only at a subconscious level. The subconscious is terribly perceptive."
"That's not true. I was shocked when it happened, when I caught him last month."
"Baloney. You were in denial, that's all. But that's not my point." "What was my point?" "Damn it, I had something awfully brilliant to tell you."
"Take your time."
"Don't get smart with me. You'll be old, too, before you know it, forgetting every damn thing. Some terribly wise point to make, and your thoughts all scatter at the critical moment. What were we talking about? Oh, that's right, fidelity. It's overrated. What the hell difference does it make if he pokes his pecker where he shouldn't?"
"It makes a big difference to me."
"That's because you're young. You think everything's about sex. God knows I did, but I also know a lot about husbands. I've had 3 of them, for God's sake, and not one of them to grow old with. And why? Because I cut the bastards off whenever they disappointed me. Now, I can't for the life of me remember what they did to disappoint. I'm sure it was awful, at the time."
"Had sex with a hooker in the stairwell of your own apartment building?"
"Oh, is that what happened? Your mama wouldn't give me any details."
"More or less," Ella said.
"Ha! Well, I've known many happy marriages that survived worse than that. You must know these women don't mean anything to him. God knows I never meant anything to poor Fred."
"Who's Fred?"
"Bitsy's husband, darling. It was just for fun. It was, I don't know, a little adventure to start the blood going. Some of us need that, you know. The thrill of novelty. It's got nothing to do with the sanctity of marriage.
Aunt Julie, this is all a little...
I realize we old folks aren't supposed to talk about sex, she said. But believe me, we had it. Lots of it. How do you think this country got so damned crowded?
Immigration? Immaculate conception?
Don't sass. But it's a funny thing, you marrying a type like that. You're supposed to marry a man like your father, aren't you? And that father of yours was never disloyal a day of his life. I don't think he ever looked at another woman after your mama. She was it for him.
Yes, she was. She is.
I adore your father. When's he coming to visit me again? He doesn't visit me nearly enough, and God knows there's few enough handsome men around this joint to begin with. Except Ricardo here, bringing our brandy at last. Ricardo, I need your opinion as a man under the age of 40, I believe. My niece here just caught her husband with another woman. A chronic condition of his, a bit like psoriasis. Should she take him back or boot him out?
Ella put her head in her hands. Ricardo set down Aunt Julie's brandy Alexander with a flourish, and then Ella's. He straightened his waistcoat and started taking away the dessert plates.
A pretty girl like that? He said. I think she must find a man who treats her right, Miss Hadley. That's what I think.
Ella waited until the door closed behind Ricardo before she tossed down her napkin, stood, and stared down at Aunt Julie's watery blue eyes. And that's a wrap. You seriously had to say that?
Of course I did. I'm old and don't give a damn. Anyway, I find Ricardo's advice invaluable. He keeps me in touch with the times. Would you sit down, please? I've got something else I want to discuss with you.
What is it?
You know, you're being terribly impolite, looming over me with that terrifying expression. Your husband was unfaithful, like millions of other husbands. Wives, for that matter. It's not the end of the world by any means, but if you can't live with it, divorce him quick. Get the sorry business over with and start fresh.
You know, you're the second person in 2 days to give me that advice.
So take it.
Ella crossed her arms.
I started proceedings yesterday, as a matter of fact. Mama gave me the name of a lawyer.
Well, then, if Mama approves, I guess that's all there is to it. She's the one with the grandkids at stake, after all. And you've got a good job, haven't you? Something to do with Wall Street, isn't it? So you can afford a little moral superiority, since you seem to want it so badly.
Actually, Ella said, blurting, really, I've probably just gotten fired.
Aunt Julie lifted her brandy. Her eyes had gone a little soft, like she was looking into another dimension.
That's nice, dear, she said.
Didn't you hear me? I said I'm going to be fired.
Now the eyes sharped.
Going to be fired? They let you know in advance?
Sort of.
But why? Why you're being fired, I mean, not why they're letting you know.
It's kind of complicated. It's called a conflict of interest. Except it isn't. I mean, I haven't actually done anything wrong, but someone called my boss...
Made enemies, have you? Good girl. If you're not making enemies, you're not getting anywhere.
Enemies?
Someone who wants you out of there, darling. Probably because you're on to something good. But don't worry. A girl like you, you'll find another job like whistling. Or another husband, whichever comes first.
Honestly, Aunt Julie, not helpful.
Why not? So you failed at something. You... what's that word? You screwed up. The world keeps spinning. Try something new. Try someone new.
You don't understand. You don't know what it means losing your job in a town like this. It's worse than divorce. Splitting up is like, well, there's two of you. You can blame the other person. If you lose your job...